Hi, this is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Lori Elster. And this is the All Access Star Trek podcast. Today, we are going to be interviewing guests Mohammed Noor and Jane Brooke, who have a web series called BioTrekkie and the Admiral, where they look at episodes of Star Trek Discovery and talk about the science in it and some of the production stuff, too. But first, let's do some news before they get here.
The first bit of news of this week is ViacomCBS has finally announced the launch date of Paramount Plus, which is the replacement of CBS All Access. That's coming on March 4th. And they didn't get into details about what we should see on March 4th, but I expect it's not just a name change, that it's going to probably be an entirely new app. I'm hoping for a whole UI upgrade and a whole new user experience beyond just the new name.
Yeah, I think everybody is. I think it could use some fine tuning.
Well, we've been seeing a lot of content from ViacomCBS over the last few months. So CBS All Access has already been Viacomed quite a bit. You know, obviously the SpongeBob and Chappelle's Show, and there's tons of content in there. More of that is supposedly coming. There's some new original shows, including a new SpongeBob show and a SpongeBob movie. And
hope you like SpongeBob. No, there's a ton of stuff.
Yeah, there's a Godfather thing. I'm not really sure, but so they are tapping into the whole family of Viacom CBS. Obviously, Star Trek is still going to be a major part of it. And you know, the first new Star Trek show that'll show up will probably be the Strange New Worlds show, which will be a Paramount Plus original series when that shows up someday.
That's exciting. I can't wait for that. And hopefully there'll be so much other content that it'll be easier to I'll subscribe for the Star Trek stuff anyway, but it would be great if there was a lot more stuff on there.
Wall Street seems to be betting that ViacomCBS has a winner on their hands, and the stock's been up ever since the announcement. So things are looking good, and hopefully it pays off. Now, we're going to learn a lot more about this next month during a investor meeting. So we'll do an update on that. So in late February, before the launch on All Access Star Trek podcast, we'll give you a full preview of what's coming on Paramount Plus.
Cool.
I'm hoping they actually, during this investor meeting, they announce some more Star Trek stuff. I'm not saying there's any promise of that, but if you remember the Disney investor thing they did a couple months ago, they announced like 20, you know, Star Wars series and Marvel series. And right. So it's possible they could roll out a whole bunch of announcements for this thing. We don't know yet.
Yeah, they certainly might have, you know, seen that and thought that it was a smart way to go.
Switching to some Discovery news, there's some more post-finale interviews with cast and the showrunner for Discovery talking a little bit about season 4. There's some discussion about how Owo is going to get some more exploration in season 4. And I think we've talked about how this character is one they seem to be bringing up more, kind of like they did this season in season 3 with Detmer. So maybe we're going to get a little more Owo in season 4.
Yeah. And she said it will test her resolve more, and that she feels like her character is always ready to fight. So that's interesting. I don't know where that's going, but it sounds good.
Michelle Paradise made it very clear that they are going to make Gray seen in season 4. The subtext being no more ghost boyfriend. And
I wouldn't even call that subtext. I call that the headline.
it's obviously a metaphor, but in general, I'm just happy that they are going past that, and you know, whatever woo-woo magic they want to come up with to make it happen, I'm all for it.
Yeah, like I'll be happy to have that story change, because it's just more interesting. And I'm happy that they'll pay off that great scene where Culber promised to Gray, like, you will be seen. And I think that was powerful stuff. So I'm happy they're going to pay it off.
Now, the most interesting thing that came out of this series of interviews, and you can see a link on our site, is Doug Jones is always very careful about spoilers. Didn't let something out, but kind of did in that he talks about how important being a captain is to Saru and how he's going to be balancing his desire to be on Kaminar and his being part of Starfleet. And I think in our last week's pod, we talked about, you know, maybe Saru's going to leave Starfleet, do something different. And it feels like that's not going to happen, that he's going to stay in Starfleet and do something Starfleety and maybe captainy.
I think Starfleet is really important to him. And I think they've shown that, like his whole origin story and all of that, is that was the catalyst for changing his whole life and elevating his understanding of the world around him. So it makes sense to me that he would fight to stay in it.
So, you know, there's a couple possibilities here, you know, one of which is he becomes the captain of another ship, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that creates a lot of production complexity, I would say. Because
right.
You need another ship, another crew, scenes away from our main people. So I don't know how much sense that, I mean, I assume it would be temporary anyway, but I'm not sure how much sense that would make. If I was trying to write a bunch of stories, that would be maybe something I wouldn't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a major part of the show, they definitely would have to build a whole set like they did for the Enterprise or like they, you know, used to have for the Shenzo. So, and you know, the stage where the Shenzo was is Starfleet HQ, and my bet is they're going to keep that for the next season.
And he'd need a crew that's a whole bunch of people and characters that aren't maybe as important as the ones we already have. We have a lot of characters already.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he specifically said Saru's really proud of being captain, and it just feels like they're not going to make him a commander again and make him first officer. So I don't know. They've painted themselves a little bit into a corner because they wanted to make Michael captain. So they've got to figure out some way to keep Doug on the show as a regular. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with, because it's not really pointing to one direction at all so far.
No, and there could be some interesting conflict, inner conflict as well as outer conflict, if that's something he wants. I mean, we just heard he said that he wants you to be the captain, right?
Yeah.
You know, we didn't actually hear him say it, so... We just know he told Vance to do it.
A couple little bits of merchandising news. There's a brand new licensee, which is always exciting when there's a new Star Trek licensee. This is a little bit of a niche thing. There's a company called XO6, and it's named after XO3, which is a Star Trek planet. And this is a very Star Trek-focused licensee who are going to be making 1/6 scale figures, action figures, they're articulated figures, very high quality. These are very large figures, amazing sculpts. And it's the same company that used to do the same thing for QMX, Quantum Mechanics. Now they're doing it for themselves. They've announced a data from First Contact figure, but they're hoping to do maybe 6 figures this year. I've talked to the people behind it. They are going to be doing all sorts of figures from across the franchise, including Discovery and the new shows. So this is exciting for collectors who like that sort of thing. These are not going to be cheap. The data figure, I think, is going to be $180. So
the details are really good, though. I was looking at the pictures that we have in the article. So it looks pretty good.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of ways you could pose it, and it comes with different hands. It comes with 2 heads, because Data in First Contact, where he has part of his face ripped off, he has that kind of Phantom of the Opera thing going on.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much exactly like things used to be with QMX. So for people who are familiar with that, this is basically the same kind of thing. And they'll also be doing statues and maybe some other stuff, but they seem fairly focused, and it's just nice to have a new licensee and one very focused on making high quality Star Trek products.
Yeah, although I miss, you know, the cheap action figures.
Well, there's cheaper action figures. The Mego is still making figures. The renewed Mego, and in fact, we've got a review of their latest wave coming up. They just arrived at Danish's house, and he's going to be reviewing those. I don't think they're going to be doing anything from the new shows. They've mostly been doing TNG and original series so far. Maybe they will do some stuff. I don't know. But
yeah, I'm not a big collector like that for expensive things, but I do have a box of action figures that I enjoy. It's like Deep Space Nine, Next Generation, Voyager. Just some fun. More for playing than for admiring.
Star Trek definitely doesn't have the mass market action figure lineup that you get with Star Wars. And that is unfortunate. It's far more of a collector's market, and there's not as much kids play type stuff with Star Trek.
Right. Even big kids play.
Yeah, not anymore. It's not the 90s anymore. And even with all these new, even with all these new shows, we're still not seeing that kind of thing happening with Star Trek, and we may not.
Right. All right. I'll accept it.
another little bit of a follow-up bit of merchandise news. A few weeks ago, we talked about an interview that you did with Una McCormick about her latest book, which was the autobiography of Catherine Janeway. And Titan Books and CBS had some good news this week, which is what?
Which is that Kate Mulgrew is reading the audiobook. Which is this month. I think it's coming out any day now. But I remember when I interviewed Una and I said, do you know if there are any plans to have her record it? And there were not plans at the time, but she was very excited. She said, wouldn't it be wonderful if she read it? She's like, I know she's heard of me. And she responded to a tweet telling her the book existed. So she was very happy about that. But she's even happier about this. She's thrilled. And there's an excerpt out there that just sounds great. She really, it is, Captain Janeway's voice is different from Kate Mulgrew's, because I've listened to some of Kate Mulgrew's recording of her own book, her memoirs that she wrote. And it's different. She really snaps into Janeway mode for this. So I think it'll sell like hotcakes.
Well, apparently she's been having practice in Janeway mode recently if she's recording for Star Trek Prodigy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's it too, because she it sounds like Janeway again. It's so fun.
That's great.
And then you have an interview that we can talk about, because you spoke to Michael Dorn.
Michael Dorn. The man has been in more Star Trek than anyone else, as Mr. Worf, of course. And I did an interview about a new film he's in, a sci-fi movie called Agent Revelation, which is out on video on demand on Friday, the day this podcast comes out. So you may want to check out that full interview. In that, he talks about the first part I posted. He talks about his time on Next Generation and his time transitioning to Deep Space Nine.
And I liked what he talked about, where he talked about Worf being a bad father. Looking at it that way, it's an enjoyable interview. He was very thoughtful, I thought.
He also talked about the challenge of moving to Deep Space Nine and how it was a little like when Diana Muldaur came on to Next Generation, and he understood how there was a little bit of tension with the cast, which came up in my interview with Alexander Siddig a couple months ago when he talked about Michael Dorn coming in and how they liked Michael Dorn, but they kind of were pissed at Paramount for bringing in someone new when they thought they had a good thing going. But they understood it was for the ratings, and Michael Dorn understood it was for the ratings, but there still was a little bit of thing. So you may want to check out that interview.
Yeah, it's definitely worth listening to. And then, so there's a part two coming out also.
Right. So by the time this podcast drops, the interview will show up on the site Friday afternoon. And second part, where we talk about a couple things. One is his Captain Worf TV show idea.
Which is actually a very interesting idea, but you can read that when the interview comes up.
Yeah, so he kind of gives it back. He has spoken to CBS All Access about it, but it doesn't sound like they're about to put it into production. Let's put it that way.
So well, it sounds expensive.
It definitely sounds expensive. But he's got some, you know, he's got a whole idea. He's got it fleshed out and he gives us the pitch so you could read all about it. I asked him specifically about Star Trek Picard. Worf was mentioned during season one, and we've heard of many actors possibly involved in season two. Laurie talked to Gates McFadden about it. That hasn't been confirmed yet, but I wanted to know whether or not he's had any discussions, and if not, what it would take to get him on the show. So let's take a listen to that.
Well, let me put it this way. I have not been contacted about that.
Okay.
So, you know, but I don't like to say yes or no. It really depends on quite a few things. You know, it depends on the role. It depends on, you know, how they want to present it. I mean, the one thing that you have to realize is that, and I think a lot of people don't, and it's not their fault. I think it's just the way things are, is that I have to get into makeup, you know? You know, you're talking about 3 hours again, you know? And, you know, for me to do that, it really has to be kind of worth it, you know what I mean? Because I don't want to just get in makeup and stand around and look, you know, scowl at people, you know?
I get why he wouldn't want to do that. But I assume that you told him about the other option.
Yeah. Well, first, you know, on Picard, he's when you read the full interview, you see he really wants to do this Captain Worf show. So he is ready to put on the makeup again. But he doesn't want to just show up on this other show and, you know, for no good reason. And I'm betting we may never see him on Picard, even though we may see everyone else, but not season two, maybe season three, they could talk him into it, but he's not chomping at the bit. But when I asked him about animated, he seemed a lot more open to the idea of doing something on Lower Decks. And even though he kind of sounded like he didn't expect to get the call, which I think is, I mean, that, you know, Mike McMahon definitely will want him on the show someday, right?
Right. I mean, the thing is, we're reading all these interviews and he's not. And so we know that Mike McMahon is a huge fan of everybody. And I feel like he's going to want everybody on there, you know, at some point over the course of the show. So, but all Michael Dorn knows is that his phone is not ringing.
Right. And he's tried to make it ring. And so he's kind of given up on it ringing. And he may not be aware that there's a hyper nerd running an animated show. And the other thing is, Michael Dorn does a ton of voiceover work these days for games and animation. So he knows the drill and he's ready to do it. So I suspect we will hear Worf again, but we may not see him again.
Or we'll see him, but he will be animated.
Right. We may not see Dorn Worf.
Right.
But we would see, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, think so too.
There is another reason why we never saw Dorn Worf on Picard, which is the whole Klingon problem, right?
The Klingon problem?
Well, we haven't seen a single Klingon. There was no Klingons in Picard season one, and there were no Klingons in Discovery season three. And obviously there were Klingons in season two of Discovery, but I feel like Alex Kurtzman and the gang are just gun shy on Klingons because they got so much crap for season one and the bald Klingons and everything. And then they did a little walk back in season two. And I kind of feel like they just don't want to do Klingons anymore.
Or maybe they're going to focus on Strange New Worlds, which is the place we might see some.
I mean, they should show up on Strange New Worlds, but then of course you run into the even weirder problem on Strange New Worlds of if you're doing it right, then they should be the old style Klingons, the kind of basically guys in dark makeup with Van Dyke's beards, right?
Right. And even separate from that, they also need to be cruel enemies. right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of want them to show up on the show because the Klingons are the ultimate Cold War adversaries of the Federation during that era, and it just seems inevitable to run into them. But it's a minefield. And so, you know, that may be one reason why they just aren't doing Klingons anymore.
Right.
Speaking of Lower Decks, one last bit of news of the week is the good news for international fans. You brought this up before, but Friday, the day this podcast arrives, is the day that Star Trek Lower Decks finally arrives outside of the USA and Canada on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. It's Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, India, more, I think. European friends who've been complaining that they haven't been able to see it are in for a treat.
If you go to trekmovie.com, you'll see an article that kind of gives you a bit of reminder of what the show is and links to all of our reviews and all of our Easter eggs. So you could kind of go back and relive what all of us people in North America have been living through back in August through October, right?
And quelling about, yeah.
So you probably have been spoiled by a few things that existed, but hopefully it's still a fun, exciting show. I mean, we love Star Trek Lower Decks, both of us. So you could also go back and re-listen to the All Access Star Trek podcast episodes. If you skipped our review portions for those episodes, you can now listen to those as well.
Lucky you. I'm so excited for everybody.
And season 2 is already in production. I think it's going to arrive this year on Paramount Plus.
Yeah, I think so too, and I'm excited. It's been fun. So well written.
We don't know if it's going to arrive on Amazon this year as well. Although, you know, why wouldn't it? But maybe they'll put a bigger gap in there. But hopefully it's all the same date whenever they come up with it for Paramount Plus.
Right. And all the episodes are dropping at the same time. So you can watch all of them.
Yep. You know, some people, by the time you listen to this podcast, may have already binged 10 episodes in a row and may just have... I mean, I think you could there's so many Star Trek references, both big and small. I think you could check OD on them. So I'd spread it out a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say it's one of those shows that you don't need to. I mean, it's not serialized, so there's no need to binge it.
Yeah, spread it out. Spread the love, because there's not a lot of new Star Trek in 2021. So I do one a week just to give myself some time.
Yeah.
So now we're going to roll an interview that we did earlier with Mohammed Noor and with Jane Brooke to talk about their show Bio Trekkie with the Admiral.
They were so much fun.
Yeah, it was really fun, relaxed conversation. We did kind of dig into some big issues like the burn, but it was a fun chat and we hope you like it. So let's take a listen. Okay, so we'd like to welcome Mohammed Noor and Jane Brooke of the brand new show, Bio Trekkie with the Admiral, which is on YouTube every Sunday night.
Thanks for coming, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Of course, Jane should be known to all Discovery fans as the actress who played the late, unfortunately, Admiral Cordwell. Mohammed Noor is a professor at Duke University and is a science consultant for Star Trek, including season 3 of Discovery.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing some science to Star Trek.
It's my pleasure. It's an honor and a pleasure, honestly, to be participating in it. I'm really, really excited about the opportunity.
Can you just tell us just how the process works as a science advisor to Star Trek?
Sure. So I should contrast my role from, say, Dr. Aaron McDonald. So Dr. Aaron McDonald is the science advisor for all the Star Trek franchise. She's actually on retainer from CBS. I'm somebody who just gets contracts periodically to help out. So the analogy I keep using when I talk to other people is I say, she's like the sheriff of science, and I'm somebody who occasionally gets deputized to help out.
I like that. That's good, Mohammed.
Thank you. Thank you. So her expertise is in astrophysics, whereas mine's in biology. So we have very complementary expertise. There's a couple of different ways that they've looped me in. One is sort of like a season specific arc. So for example, for season 3 of Discovery, one of the things that Dr. McDonald and I worked on together was the science behind the burn. And the writers already come up with the idea that there's going to be this Kelpian, that this Kelpian's isolated on a planet. It's gone through an extreme grief. And somehow that is supposed to cause all dilithium everywhere to become inert and everything to blow up. So then that's passed over to us and said, here, science this. No problem. So that's sort of a big one. That's where, you know, Aaron and I then worked, you know, used our complementary expertise and came up with some sort of narrative that at least has some roots in science. Obviously, it has some aspects which are, I like to say, creative.
Science fiction.
Yep. There you go. Exactly. Science Perfect. Fiction. Alternatively, it could be something much more specific, like an episode-specific thing. So, for example, I had a contract for episode 5 to work out what this disease was that the aliens who showed up at that space station had. And they said it's something that's associated with a food that they had consumed. It has to be non-communicable. It has to be something that finding this seed chip would help them figure out a cure towards. So I basically scienced out like, well, how about if we use prions and, you know, filled in some text and things like that. And occasionally it's something really, really small, like Dr. McDonald will sometimes just literally text me a line and say, like, is this sentence okay?
Well, so on your show, you guys are going through each episode one or two at a time, right? So you did the first episode, which had the transworms in it, and there was a lot of discussions about the transworms. So were you watching the transworms for the first time, or did you actually have any involvement with them?
I did not have any involvement with it ahead of time. So when you say in our show, you're referring at this point to Bio Trekkie with the Admiral. Yeah, no, yeah. I had not seen anything about the transworms prior to seeing it on the screen.
I was really happy you guys said, I didn't realize that the transworm's name was Molly until you guys pointed it out.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved that. It just immediately made her, you know, likable, even though she was eating people, but they were bad people. So,
yeah. Fair enough.
That was a great point. I loved it when Jane raised that. That was fantastic.
Yeah, I hadn't even noted, like I missed it somehow. So I thought that was fascinating. And I actually really enjoyed that particular discussion about the swallowing Michael and eating the bad guys.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
How do you imagine the transworms trance? Like if they are transworms and mesmerizing, What would you imagine that biological process being?
Well, it could be pretty simple. And if you think of like literally the example we always use is deer in headlights, right? So somehow it draws in your attention and maintains your focus. Because I don't think it's supposed to be like a long term trance where they make you into a zombie kind of thing. I think it's literally just it makes you pause long enough for you to eat it. So in some ways, it's just a surprising sort of signal. It's the way I've at least been imagining it in my head, but. Obviously, there's plenty of room for imagination for alternative versions, too.
As I was listening to you guys talk about it, I was wondering if in the process of doing your show, did you watch the whole season and then decide to talk about each episode? Or did you only watch up to the point that you were going to discuss?
Well, that's funny because we, I think up to the point that we were going to discuss that time.
Yep.
Right, Mohammed? Because we thought it would be more
natural,
current, spontaneous. Mm-hmm. And also because, yeah, that was better that way. We knew that we couldn't release it until the season was finished. Mm-hmm. So we watched it in our respective homes, North Carolina and Los Angeles. And then mm-hmm. we would call each other and say, okay, what do you have with that one for that one? You know, and it was fun. It was really a fun way to watch the season.
It was really fun. I loved trading insights on that. That was fantastic.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we just had a fun like rhythm where we'd watch and then we would email the next day and Mohammed yep. would be like, I got 3 great things. And, you know, do you have anything you want to talk about? Or often Mohammed would be curious about something on the production side and he'd say, I'd love to ask you A, B, and C. And I'd say, go for it. You know, at the end, we it's mostly biochecky, but at the end, Mohammed would ask me questions about, you know, production.
And your insights on biology were always really good, because you saw things in the biology that I wasn't picking up on, because I was just watching it as a biologist. But you say, well, why does they do blah? I'm like, oh, that's a good question. I hadn't even thought of that. So yeah. it was very complimentary. I loved it.
Yeah. Questions from the street. I thought I'd give the questions from the street to the professor of biology. And yeah, having had like one semester of college level biology before I moved on.
Yeah, same. I had one semester of theater.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's so perfect. That's so perfect. So, oh, we did a swap.
Yeah. What made each of you drop out? What made?
Oh, I mean, I never planned to major in theater. I just took it as an area requirement. It was fun. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it was so one off.
I did plan on majoring in it. So, no, what I had wanted to do was major in environmental science, which was not as popular way back then, and so I ended up going to Duke and just saying, oh, okay, I'll major in biology. And I remember very distinctly sitting in a lecture, one of those bowl lectures, a small bowl, but there's lots of kids, you know, the seats go up, up, up. And there was this botany professor on the stage, and he was so full of excitement over the subject. And I remember looking at him and thinking, you know, I kind of know all that I need to know. Like, I know why the leaves change color. I know why, you know, it was like, I realized that I loved camping. I loved nature, but I didn't need to carry on. I don't know if that was the right decision. They didn't have, you know, they didn't have advisors way back then in college. So I kept switching my major and ending up in theater, which is kind of a leap.
Well, it seems like it worked out.
Yeah. It did. Yeah. It worked out. Yeah. That's what life is, what happens when you're making other plans, like they say.
Oh yeah.
So you guys have seen the whole season, and have you recorded all of your shows already?
Yes, we have. At least for season three. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's do some spoilers on your shows then, maybe. What, looking at the whole season, I'll start with Mohammed. What was maybe your favorite bit of sci-fi biology for season three?
It's so hard to pick, because there were so many interesting things, and some of it were things I knew were coming. So I was excited to see, like I mentioned with the prions, because I actually had some role in it. So I was really excited to see that. On the other hand, that wasn't really a focus of the show. It was just something kind of happening in the background. So I can't imagine anybody else would say that was their favorite part. I mean, for me, I was surprised how much genetics came up throughout the show, especially in the last couple of episodes. And honestly, a lot of the genetics that came up in the last couple of episodes are things that the writers themselves came up with. And it was things that I hadn't seen before. Like, oh, that's really interesting. That's really creative. And then basically trying to then provide my own headcanon for what does that mean? How would that connect in there? So that was, for me, that was really fun. In terms of just the plots and the action, I mean, I liked the last couple of episodes quite a bit, as well as the episode on Navarre. That was a really fun, interactive one.
And Jane, maybe the same question for you, either, you know, biology or just favorite moments or favorite performances.
Well, you know, I think what I'm left with, having watched the whole season, is such an appreciation. I loved, this is not going to surprise anyone that I watch the acting, but I just loved all the actors and all the guest actors they had. I just thought the level of the acting on all counts was so great, from the, you know, from parts that only, like the man who appeared at the very beginning of the first episode and then appeared at the very end of the last one. He was so good and, you know, so solid. We only saw him a couple of times, but everyone, Sonequa, so I loved all the acting and I loved the writing this season. I just really felt that it was deep and well thought out. I loved that it ended up in a place where they called for connection, which is poignant considering yesterday's events, or January 20th. And it's just a call for understanding that we're all connected. I just thought that was great of Michelle Paradise to end the season on. So, yeah.
And was there anything that popped to either of you in a sci-fi way as like just a really intriguing kind of principle?
Well, I kept wondering what I know a bunch of people were. I mean, I did wonder what the heck happened there, you know, with the burn and all of that. So I was intrigued by this idea of the burn. I'm trying to think. Muhammad, what about you? I'm sure I'm forgetting.
The burn, I knew about it. I was good. I didn't say anything. But so this is very minor, but I really found those sea locusts really interesting. Just as you know, just sort of some sort of funny organism that came out of the water and they became this pest and they were spread all around. And how do they fly like that? I mean, I found it just as a biologist, like, wow, what is that? It's a really interesting organism.
And they were so cute. They were like whimsical. They were the ones that book parted. I loved those.
Yeah,
I loved those.
I sort of felt bad for them, or should we feel bad for them? Because at the end of the episode, Book and his brother kind of send them back out to sea, but wasn't the whole point that there was no food left? So what's next for the sea locusts?
No, I think there was no food left on the planet that they had unintentionally raised, you know, that they were going back to where they came from. I didn't get a sense that things would go back into order, that they were going back where they belonged, and that,
agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Not exactly the same sense as Gene. I didn't think they were going back to die, but we did joke in our, in our recording that, you know, how could they fly like that? The only thing I could come up with is that somehow they had hydrogen in them. I thought, wow, it'd be really bad if you let one of those on fire.
don't go near a fire if that's it. Right. Yeah.
You guys had an interesting discussion in, I think it was your first episode, about the questioning like humanoids and aliens and stuff. And I thought something that also occurred to me was, what do you think about what would happen to humans in 1,000 years? And what, because the show is set 1,000 years forward, do you expect that we should be able to interact and deal with humans in 1,000 years and they will be biologically the same as we are today?
I'd say short answer is probably yes. I mean, if you think back to like what did humans look like probably 1,000 years ago, they probably didn't look radically different from what we look like now. I mean, you know, probably there was a lot more malnutrition and things like that, but in the grand scheme of human evolution, 1,000 years is very, very small. I think we'd be basically the same. Now, of course, one thing that isn't considered, and this is where canon versus real life may be different, is whether there's some sort of genetic engineering that takes place that's a little bit more intense than happens now. Now, according to Trek canon, you're not supposed to have genetic engineering. That's very frowned upon. We hear that a lot in, say, Deep Space Nine and things like that. But that would be one area which may make differences bigger than, for example, the past 1,000 years.
Wouldn't there also be, I mean, this has always been a slightly dubious, I imagine, this notion that humans can mate with aliens.
I mean, that's definitely dubious.
we did talk a little bit about that, didn't we, Muhammad?
Yeah, exactly. The only way that really works, at least in my mind, the only way that really works is if the aliens have a recent Earth origin related to humans, you know, so it's basically like somebody took Neanderthal from Earth and moved them to some other world. And then we came in contact with them later, because again, you know, humans and Neanderthal interbred, you know, say 50,000 or more years ago. So if, you know, Vulcans or Cardassians or whatever, you know, have a similar divergence time, yeah, that'd probably be doable. But if they're, either if A, they're completely independent, or B, if they have an origin back, you know, billions of years ago, no, there's no way we'd be able to interbreed with them. That absolutely wouldn't work. I mean, we literally would be more closely related to, you know, trees than we are to those aliens.
So, because I thought that, but it was never clear, and maybe you could clear this up. I thought there was something about Book that he was kind of a evolved, different kind of human, and as was his brother, because he had this empathic capability, and his forehead would glow. But I could never figure out, was that a natural or a technological thing? Do you have any answers about that?
Right. Was that his whole species or just a few of them? We argued about this a lot on our podcast.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, obviously, I don't know the answer because I don't think it was ever laid out. In my headcanon, I mean, actually, I think something that involves some sort of engineering would probably make sense. But it's hard to know. Or maybe it's, like you said, maybe it's purely technological. Maybe it's not even really biological. Maybe he has implants of some sort.
I don't know. I always thought it was kind of him and his brother, his people had this ability, but that's a good question. I didn't really question it while watching.
Well, I mean, going to the real world, the world we live in, I've always envisioned that, you know, maybe in 100 or 200, that we hear about people wanting to integrate technology and genetic engineering. And I think it's quite, is it crazy to think that humans may, diverge into those who kind of have technological advancements and genetic advancements and those who don't?
Well, you know, I'm going to jump in right here. Please. Because years ago, and it was before its time, but you guys probably don't even know the movie Gattaca.
I remember that.
Oh, very well. Yeah. I remember you being in it too. You were
I played Ethan Hawke. I always joke, I gave birth to Ethan Hawke in that movie.
I need to watch that again.
That was a difficult baby. No, but it addressed this very issue of, and I remember, I don't know why they didn't include it. I had to go back and watch that movie. It's been years. But I remember when I did go to watch it, they didn't have at the end of the movie, the legend that I had read in my script. And, you know, that whole movie is about basically ultimately everyone being kind of forced to engineer their babies and engineer out anybody who is in our minds not perfect. And at the end of the movie in the script, they had a legend and it said, these are the people who would never have been born if this were the case that we engineered everybody. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it was everyone from Mozart to Einstein to, you know, Michelangelo, or because so many of those people might have had something in quotation marks wrong with them, mm-hmm. that would have been engineered out. So it's a very interesting discussion. And then of course, Ethan Hawke in the movie overcomes his difficulty. It's the fact that he has an supposedly imperfect genetics that helps him overcome and do good things or whatever. I don't know. So if we do go down that road, that's sad, all the special people who would not be with us.
Absolutely agreed. Absolutely agreed.
Jane, you obviously have this interest in science, and I wonder, because I know certainly on Discovery, they usually have a writer on set. Mm-hmm. And so when something's happening and your characters has to deal with something, do you ever go to them and say, can you explain this to me? Like, I mean, one of my favorite things, I hate to bring it up because I know it's sad, is your death scene, right? So you're in this room.
We talked about it a lot.
There's a torpedo and Pike is on the other side of a door. And all of us were joking, like, why isn't the whole ship made out of whatever's that door's made out of, you know?
Right. Oh my God. I didn't even think of that. Yeah. That's so funny. I think that it was like, we talked about it a lot at the time. And I think, I don't know, I can only make many, many different guesses. But one very practical guess is that what are you going to do with that Admiral if she's on your ship into the future? You know, like, it's moving. If you have people die, everyone has people die in TV shows these days. You know, it used to be years ago, if somebody was a regular, I was not a regular, but if somebody was a regular, they would never kill them off. But these days they do it in everything from Game of Thrones to on. So I think that they wanted to have a powerful storyline and, you know, losses and practically speaking, what would the Admiral do just standing around on Discovery 950 years later. But, we did struggle with that. I remember Anson and I being like, okay, how exactly, what are we going to do? And then I remember just saying, can we make sure that we do this in the most dignified way possible, so that, and make it look as much as we can like nothing else could have been done, you know? So I don't know. But people have talked about it ever since. Yeah, why didn't they send a robot in there? Why didn't they? And also, it was very close to the door. So, you know, we would joke, why do I not just push the button and then throw myself under the door? But that was not meant to be. So it is what it is, you know.
That is what I was thinking when I rewatched it recently. I was like, you could have just, boom, gone right under there.
Just jumped. Yeah. Oh, you thought, yeah, I know. I go, can we do something where it doesn't look like I could just jump right under the door? So I think we tried, but Yeah.
You had
Maybe
a lot
she
of...
wanted to die.
You had a lot of technobabble leading up to that, I noticed, because I was rewatching it. And I was sort of the same. It's similar to what Tony just asked. But like when you get all that mouthful of technobabble, do you try to tell yourself what it means so that you can deliver it that way?
I do. I do try so that, I mean, I know I've had much more technobabble in things like medical shows. And I absolutely want to know exactly. Sometimes in Star Trek, you know, you'll ask and maybe the writer who happens to be on the set right there might not know exactly scientifically. But yeah, you try to get a specific idea, at least of what you're looking at, what part of the engine you were looking at and trying to struggle with. And yeah. Otherwise, it's just so general, you know.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I've got to toss in a plug for Jane on this. At the start of our videos, you know, we have that little quick exchange thing. And sometimes I would flub that because I couldn't remember what I'm supposed to say. That's the only part that we actually really rehearsed. And Jane would always be like, no, picture the words in your mind. And it was really neat hearing the sort of tactics, that it, you know, saying like, oh, yeah, that does work better. Thank you.
Yeah, because just the simple, hi, I'm Mohammed Noor, you know, from Duke University. People don't normally have to do stuff like that. I can't remember. And then, yeah, we would have those little plugs at the beginning, right, Mohammed?
Yeah, that's exactly the part I would often flub. And we'll have a bloopers video in about 2 weeks that we'll put out.
It's one of the things I like about your show is that you're both interested in the same things, but come from these different backgrounds. And therefore you're asking each other questions. You know, maybe this is another spoiler, but so kind of the same question of, you know, Mohammed, what's something you learned from Jane you didn't know, and Jane, you know, vice versa, while you're making the show, from each other, learning from each other?
Oh, literally almost every episode. So I remember asking about, for example, the walk and talks that, you know, people would do it. And I didn't know that she would literally like pace backwards and count out the sentence and the struggles with, you know, if the pacing is off, where it looks like you're not in as much of a hurry as you should have been in given the emergency aspect of the scene or something like that. That was fascinating. I thought that was really great. But like literally every episode I learned something really cool. But that's one example.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I mean, I didn't know. We even made it a plug for one of the shows. Not a plug, but, you know, that intro thing. You know, who would know that slugs breathe through a little hole in their side? Or who would know that fireflies, it's the females that are down close to the grass? I mean, I grew up with fireflies and the males who are up high. Or that there are different species of fireflies. Or that sometimes there are females down in the grass giving the other species signal. Yeah. And then the male comes down and they eat the male. I never knew that. I mean, there's all sorts of, I never knew this question that you asked at the beginning of the show about, is there, you know, the humanoids and the possibility of interspecies, you know, breeding and, you know, I never knew. I thought like everyone else that you could just, you know, mate or whatever I'm losing term, biological terms, but I didn't know that certain things would be impossible. You know, I was thinking more in that science fiction way that you could just join up two species and figure it out. And Mohammed explained why that just wouldn't work, or certainly why there would be no offspring. It would be not a fertile situation, but gosh, there were so many things. Yeah, I'd have to go through all the shows, but
that's what I was thinking too.
Female fireflies, that was just like kind of hilarious and awful. Watch out for them.
Sometimes I notice, like Mohammed, because you're a big Star Trek fan, like we are, so you'll have a lot of background from all the other shows. Like when you were talking about the Trill and you're sort of giving the explanation, Jane, has that at all piqued your interest in going back and watching any of the older shows, or have you had specific episodes that Mohammed might say, "Hey, you might want to watch this one"?
You know, Mohammed did when I visited Duke. It's a year and a half ago now, or something. Before I went to Las Vegas, could you give me a list of like the highlights? Because there's just so many shows. Oh, yeah. And he did give me a list of, you should watch this. You should understand what the very first Star Trek was. And, you know, that Shatner wasn't the first guy, and that this happened and that happened. And I really enjoyed, do you know that before I went to Las Vegas last time, I thought, I'm a little bit of a binger here, but I sat on the window seat and I watched like for hours and hours. My kids were like, what are you doing? I watched from the afternoon way into the night for hours and hours and hours. And Joan Collins and just all the different shows. I have to go back again, but I have to look up that list again, Muhammad, and maybe
I can make it for you again.
Yeah. It's amazing that people can keep so much of the Star Trek Bible in their, or, you know, isn't that what they call it, the Star Trek Bible, it's a canon, in their mind, you know, that they can remember so many specifics, you know. It's fantastic.
Muhammad, as someone who loves Star Trek so much, do you get nervous when the show starts playing with things that are canon? Like, for example, a little thing like Osiris says Orions have 6 valve hearts or something like that. And were you involved in that? And is that the kind of thing where you have to think, okay, well, now we're kind of redefining a little bit of Star Trek history here, and you have to go back and make sure it all makes sense and that kind of thing?
So that's a great question. So, well, first on the specific example, I wasn't involved in the Osiris 6 valve heart. But honestly, I don't worry about it. I mean, I know some people get very, very concerned about canon and continuity and things like that. So let me preface what I'm saying here. I'm talking now as a viewer, not as a consultant. But I don't worry about those things because I fear canon always evolves. There's always going to be some things where like, okay, now we're going to change this. Now we're going to change that. And honestly, if it was static for over 50 years, there would be a lot of really boring aspects to it because things just don't work now the same way they would have worked 50 years ago. So that doesn't bother me the least. Now, if I'm consulting, then yes, I'm very concerned that I don't want to do something that somebody's going to call me out on. So if there is going to be some sort of change, I would want to, you know, make sure that it ties in some way or have the change explained in some way.
What does having a 6 valve heart mean? Like, does that, what would that tell you about a species? Does it say anything?
I have no idea. That's an honest answer. I honestly haven't given it any thought prior. I mean, I could make up something on the spot, but it wouldn't be very thoughtful. I didn't give that much thought when it came up on the screen, though.
weren't they being almost metaphorical with it, though? That wasn't she sort of saying, I could be really cold on one side of my heart, I could be really nice on another side? They were being kind of, I don't know, poetical about it.
Yep. There was some kind of point she was making.
But the complexity, that's what it was. The complexity.
Yeah, she was speaking to Ken. That's right. She was speaking to Ken, and he couldn't believe that she had been so helpful. And then she's like, let me tell you, you know, I've got different rooms in this heart, honey.
Speaking of Osiris, do you find it easier to play a protagonist or an antagonist, Jane?
I think it's more fun. Maybe I found it more fun as life goes on to play an antagonist in a way. A lot of the parts that are so fun that you can get your teeth into, especially if they're so different from your own life. I can think of parts more recently like Goneril and King Lear or, you know, I don't know, just some bad guys. Maybe I enjoyed playing those because I was always playing more the protagonist in my younger years. And kind of as you age, then you're like, it was funny, like many times in a row, starting about 10 years ago, I'd be asked to play drug addicts or people dying of cancer. I'm like, I'm just getting older. You know, you don't, it would be like, you know, they'd be asking me to play parts like that. It was fun. But it really always depends on the writing. So I enjoy playing either as long as the writing's really good.
Knowing you, it's really hard to imagine you as the antagonist.
No, that's what's fun. Although, you know, like for Cornwell, for example, mm-hmm. they were going to have her on just for 3, and then she was supposed to die on Cancri, right? Is that right? She was supposed mm-hmm. to, they said, oh, you're going to die in that, you know, ambush. And then they said, nah, let's have her taken prisoner. And then the character started to really take off and they started to really write for her. And that was just a blast because they really made her multifaceted. You weren't quite sure at one point, was she going to be a bad guy or was she going to be a good guy? So I really enjoyed playing her because she was so multi. She had so many levels to her. She wasn't just a cardboard cutout.
No, she was tough.
I think tough, those yeah. those scenes with Mary Chifo as Laurel, I think, really was like a big pivot point, because I just rewatched those and I was kind of blown away by the two of you, just the intensity of that. And there's so much going on. It was impressive.
We had so much fun. And when we walked into that scene, I think that's the first time I met her, when we had to do that torture scene. And it was, we've told that story before, Mary and I, but that was a way, way longer scene. But so often in TV, they have like, they're 12 minutes over when they get the, you know, editor's cut. And they're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? So they edited that scene from like the beginning and then jumped to the end, which, and it still worked incredibly. But yeah, I remember Mary walking in and, you know, you could see the question on her face, like, what are we going to do with this scream? Like, how are we going to do that? And I said, we're just going to do it. We're each going to have something in our heart and mind about what it means to us, and we're just going to go for it. Because you can't back down from something that big, you know? But we had a great time, Mary and I.
Yeah, that fight scene too. You guys had a hell of a fight scene.
Yeah, we had a great fight scene. We had so much fun doing that, and we had to practice that. And then we had a really, I think one of the most moving scenes between us was when I go to her and I say, at the end of the scene, I say, how does this end? And she says, it doesn't. But that was a very, a very like, we respected each other, but she's in prison and I'm, you know, we had to be cagey with each other, but we had to be very direct with each other. And I thought that was a moving scene when she was in the brig. Yeah.
So I want to go loop back to a hot topic, which we brought up earlier, which is The Burn and Sukal.
No pun intended, right? A hot topic.
Exactly.
Or pun intended.
So can you talk us through, because it sounds like this is something you were involved with.
Yep.
Can you talk us through what are some of the concepts you pitched that got into the show?
Sure.
And maybe explain to us, as pretend I just watched the episode. And my question to you is, okay, I still don't understand The Burn. Can you please explain it to me?
Sure. Well, let me start with the second part and then come back to the first part. And feel free to interrupt me and ask me to elaborate on anything, or if I use jargon to say, wait, stop. So there were multiple challenges associated with this. There's the physics associated with what's going to make dilithium stop working. Right. And so I don't know if you saw Dr. Aaron McDonald and I wrote an article in StarTrek.com that basically lays out what our vision was for The Burn overall. So I'll try to say her parts to it too, but I don't think I can do it justice relative to her words. But on the physics side, what she proposed was that dilithium has both a regular space and a subspace component to it. And we even tossed out the idea that maybe that's where the dye in dilithium comes from. Now, what dilithium does is it regulates the matter-antimatter reactions that are used to power the ship and to power the warp drive and things like that. So by regulating, what does that mean? Is it means it's keeping antimatter and matter from coming together and just causing this, you know, chain reaction, massive explosion, but it's controlling how it's happening. So if you stop the regulator, then it's going to go nuclear, I guess you could say, right? So that was the idea of what the physics aspect is to that. Now, on the biology side, we just needed Sukal to be different from other Kelpians and somehow resistant to whatever this radiation is that's on this crash ship that he's on. So I proposed the typical solution to making somebody different, and you see this, of course, especially in the Marvel universe, is like, oh, he's a mutant. Oh, you have these mutations. But mutations are really hard to make work well, because especially if they happen when you're already, you know, more than like an embryo, you're going to get different mutations in all your different cells. The most likely outcome is like cancer or death or some other sort of bad malfunction. You're not going to get somebody that just gets superpowers. So what I proposed in there, and the word that got used in there by Dr. Culber, was that there are epigenetic changes. And what epigenetic changes are, is those are changes not in the letters of the DNA, not in the ACGT that you see in DNA sequences, but in basically environmental effects on how much a gene is turned on or off. And these are very common, and that's something that can be more regulated in the sense that like whole organs might be responding fairly similarly as opposed to with a mutation. So I said there could be some epigenetic changes. The other thing we tossed in there was this idea, and this was just tossed out as a hypothesis, not as a for sure thing, is that rather than just being a regular Kelpian, that Sukal is a polyploid. Now, we are what's called diploids. We have two copies of every gene. We get one copy of every gene or every chromosome from our mom, one copy of every gene or every chromosome from our dad. Polyploids get more than two in total. So they get like maybe both copies from both parents if the parents were diploid. Now, a lot of plant species and a lot of microbes are polyploids. You see sometimes in like fish and frogs as well too. One of the things that seems to sometimes do, not always, but sometimes do, is it seems to be associated with higher tolerance for stressful conditions. Now, there's different ways that happen. Some of them aren't immediate. Some of them might be more over multiple generations. But some of them, at least in microbes, seem to be literally that maybe they just have more copies of their DNA template, right? Because they have, instead of just having two copies of genes, they have four. So if they are, let's say the DNA is being broken by some sort of radiation, you know, you have more copies there that can keep working or that can be used as templates for repair. So this was an idea that was tossed in there to help maybe make it so he's working together, that he's working okay. So if you put together now, Sukal is different from regular Kelpian. Let's say this difference is associated with something about how he screams, such that now when he screams, his scream is happening. This is now tying back a little bit back to Dr. McDonald's aspect. His scream happens at the resonant frequency of dilithium. So you can think of it like an opera singer who can shatter a glass or something like that. When he screams, what it's doing is it's not shattering dilithium, but it's shattering somehow that connection between the regular space and subspace components of dilithium. Subspace is not limited to, and subspace is again a fictional word, but at least in Star Trek, it's not relegated to having effects that travel at the speed of light, but can travel much faster than the speed of light. So if that subspace component is separated out, that effect can transmit to other places. By transmit to other places, it's then again decreasing this connection between regular space and subspace. In dilithium everywhere else, the matter-antimatter reaction goes crazy. All the ships blow up. So a lot of steps in there.
That is very, it's that I now understand it more. And the way you describe it, and this may get into spoiler territory, but the way you describe it is there could be more to Sukal than meets the eye.
Indeed.
Because at the end, he says something to the effect of, I want to make it better. Lori, help me.
I think it's, I want to make it right. I think.
Right, or I want to fix things.
Yeah.
So perhaps he could do another scream and he could, this polyploy thing could have more flexibility than a one-time thing.
Yeah, would you say that's reason?
That seemed like that they were opening the door for future, you know, but yeah, he definitely wants to set it right.
Although they have a ton of dilithium now, I don't, you know, do they need him to fix all the old dilithium? Because now they seem to have plenty of it. So
that's true.
Yeah. Well, luckily, I think they're on that dilithium nursery, right? So it was a place where new dilithium was being formed. So I think that's how they got the extra dilithium. It's not like all dilithium permanently was gone, but it just at the point of that initial scream.
I have another sciencey question for you, if that's okay.
Please.
So this is like way later in the, very late in the season, but that very bizarre conversation that Vance and Osira have about how apples are made of shit. Like,
that's a good question.
It was a crazy question, but of course, replicators have been on Star Trek for a long time, you know, since Next Generation. Mm-hmm. So I'm just sort of like, do you think that was like an evolution and that was always the case? Or does that make sense? I'm just so curious about that.
I'm guessing that probably, well, I mean, what they used for the raw material could change because maybe they used dirt rather than poop. But I mean, the things, I mean, if you have carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, you can make, you know, a ton of stuff. And, you know, a lot of that, it's in our products.
I thought the implication might have been that they just had so little after the burn that's what they had to use.
Yeah. You know? But on the other hand, it would be a good efficiency thing, even on just a regular starship. I mean, why carry around a lot of dirt to make your food? Though again,
waste.
Exactly. But thinking back to Canada, do you remember the food they had in the original series? Those little strange cube puffs and things like that. They didn't have apples, so I guess there are some changes then.
Right. Well, they had the occasional chicken sandwich, but that's also true. A big bowl of, you know, colorful blobs.
Yep.
You mentioned in your last episode, and I assume this is one of the things where you didn't see this until you saw it on the show, but you kind of threw a little shade on the concept of parasitic ice.
I just didn't want to try to science it out. That's all. I mean, the idea, it's an interesting and creative thought. I just didn't want to have to try to come up with science. I'd be like, is it alive or is it not alive? I have no idea if it is or not.
I guess it made me think, have they ever come to you with something and you've just said, that's not possible? Or is there always a way?
I mean, to some extent, there has to be a way, right? In the sense that, like, if it's, what's the quote that you said before, Jane, about, like, it's in the script or something? Do you remember the quote?
Oh, yeah. It's the analogy would be an actor going up to the writer and saying, you know, pointing to their script and saying, you know, my character would never say that. And then the writer takes the script and looks at it and says, yeah, yes, they would. He says it right here.
Exactly. And it makes sense because, I mean, this isn't an episode of National Geographic or Nova. I mean, this is Star Trek. So, I mean, if they want to do something that's fictional, then, you know, so be it. I mean, and again, Trek has a long tradition of, you know, clearly fictional aspects like Q or Trelane or any of these things. I mean, you know, you can have the occasional thing like that. It makes for good storytelling.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
We'd lose a lot of our favorite episodes, I think, if everything had to be explained in a way that made perfect sense.
Definitely. Definitely.
Let's talk about what's coming up for, you've got 8 more episodes. How many episodes are you doing this season?
I don't remember the number, but we have, the very first episode was the single, but then everything else we do pairs. So
yeah, so we've aired 7. 2 of them. We've aired up to 3, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I guess we have 7 total then, right? Because 6 times 2 plus 1. Yeah.
Yeah. So 5.
So, So the next episode is on Sunday. Can you maybe give us a preview of that and maybe any other highlights of the season? And do you have any special guests or anything you want to talk about?
We do have, I'll let you mention the surprise for the end, Jane, if that's cool. But on the next episode, we'll definitely talk about the prions, because that was, again, that was a piece where I actually contributed something. So I felt like I had something to say that wasn't just as a viewer, but a little bit on the behind the scenes aspect. So it'll be fun to go into that. I honestly don't remember exactly what this is. We recorded.
Yeah, it was 4 November. And 5. I do remember 4 didn't have as much biology, and 5 was the one that you had consulted on a lot. So you had, we had more to say about 5 by a lot, you know, biology wise.
That's right. And we did talk on the biology about the seed banks here on Earth too. That was the
other piece. Yes, that was cool. That was very cool.
Yeah. Do you want to mention what our surprises for the last one?
The very last one, and you'll have to talk about the technology of that, but sure. We thought we would do it live, meaning that Mohammed and I would watch it down with everyone with a live chat. So if people wanted to, type in their questions, we would be typing away answering. It won't be on camera, but it will be, you know, in a chat, right, Mohammed? Is that
exactly? Exactly. Yeah. So it's a YouTube premiere. So what'll happen is, you know, the recording of us that we already recorded right after the episode aired will air, but then we'll be both together in chat and can talk about things.
Right.
Well, we'll make sure to let fans know on our social when that's coming up. That'll be your final episode, which will be in like 2 months or something.
February 21st.
Yeah. Oh, you already knew.
Sunday the 21st. Yeah.
Do you imagine this show will have another season?
Are you talking about Discovery or are you talking about BioTrek
with the Admiral? BioTrek with the Admiral. We know Discovery has another season. Yeah,
Discovery will go on for a while, I'm sure.
They're filming it right now.
Yeah, they've already filmed it, haven't they? Oh, they're filming it now. Yeah, right.
Yeah. We've talked about doing more episodes. We haven't come to a firm conclusion yet on exactly what or when, but we've talked about doing more, right?
Yeah, we have. And going back to the first 2 seasons or going forward when it comes out, whichever. It's a fun thing to do, and we have fun.
Definitely.
Mohammed and I, and learn some stuff. And
It's just fun hanging out and chatting about these
things. Exactly, yeah.
There's one other science-y thing from season 3 Lori and I have debated quite a bit, which is the character of Gray and the holodeck on the Kelpian ship recognizing Gray. I don't know if you were involved in that, but you know, if not, then in your head canon, we understand the story thing they were going for, which is they wanted to make Gray seen, right? And that was an important metaphor they were creating. Mm-hmm. But as a Star Trek fan who understands the Trill, mm-hmm. we're trying to figure out why did the holodeck identify Gray, but not the six other hosts?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I have a headcanon on it. I was not involved in Gray or Adira either. But my headcanon is that somehow Gray is stored differently inside the symbiont. So it's, and you can think of it just like there's this extra subset of doors that somehow Gray got confined to this extra subset in a different sort of way. And that's why, you know, Gray is distinct from the others. And if you think about it, you know, we have, and we talked about this in one of our episodes, I don't remember if this is one that already came out or not, but there's, you know, we have a microbiome, right? And in the sense that we are not just this, you know, the human cells, but we have all these other cells in there. So if you imagine the other bacteria and things like that are associated with us are all different organisms, but maybe somehow this holodeck picked up those extra nerve cells within the symbiont and somehow called that a different organism, you know, rightly or wrongly so. And that's where Gray is contained. So that's my headcanon, no pun intended, on the head aspect.
I needed that. It's been something that's, you know, from the minute when Adira started seeing Gray and then when Gray materialized there, I keep going, what's so different about Gray? So I appreciate your headcanon very much.
Is there a physiological difference in brain chemistry or brain biology between short-term memory and long-term memory?
Oh, I'm not a neurobiologist. I wouldn't try to answer that. I'm not sure. I assume the answer is yes, but I'm not positive how that works.
Okay. So that might be a parallel. Because yeah. You hear people talk about short-term memory and long-term memory, and I think those are physiological things, but I have no idea.
I think that's true too, but I wouldn't swear to it. I would imagine, though, in the case of Gray, that would still be long-term, because it's not like Gray just passed away. I mean, Gray has been gone for, you know, at least months, if not years. So I assume that still would have transitioned to long-term memory, though, because I always think of short-term memory in the context of, like, hours as opposed to, you know, months and years.
I think they say it's a year, right?
Is that right? I couldn't remember.
Gray was the last host. So if you think about the symbiote, if it had like a lineup of hosts, mm-hmm. you know, it would be in the on deck, you know, the last yeah. position.
Right.
Last so in, maybe first out.
Right. Maybe that's good. Gray's, you know, also, I mean, the only one that Adira really needs to see. So, you know, yeah. just from the story point of view, maybe her heart just calls him out. Who knows?
Oh.
That's my poetical answer.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Yeah. That's much more creative. And maybe that somehow has a neurological effect too. So,
right. Yeah.
Oh, that works. I like
maybe it's
that.
Her need more than Gray's. I don't know.
We should write fan fiction together.
Exactly.
On our last podcast, I kind of joked that the reason is going to be the power of love, and which is basically
That's there you go. That's what pops into my mind as I listened to you guys, that it was really, that's what it seemed to be.
Yeah, I thought much more mundanely. I like your idea better.
No, there has to be science behind it too. Yeah.
Well, and you guys touched on this a little bit when you were talking about the Trill on your show, but I've often thought about the same thing you guys brought up, which is how did this relationship between the symbionts and the Trill happen?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a theory on that?
Yeah, the only one I tossed out in the show that maybe literally somebody was swimming and the Trill came up like a leech.
Yeah, you were joking about that. Yeah,
attached itself to the spine and then all of a sudden, you know, somehow it transmitted a couple of feelings or thoughts or something.
But, you know, it's an interesting concept because there is, and I'm not an expert on any of this, but, you know, I think there was psychological theories about symbiosis and, you know, empathic people taking on, for example, you know, the trauma of their parents. And I don't know. It's interesting. It's not only the bodies, but it seems to be a mind and emotional thing as well.
Totally.
So,
Muhammad, would you think it would fit Star Trek canon and be biologically reasonable for the symbiont of Dax to still be alive in the 32nd century?
Say yes. Just kidding.
I mean, I don't think we have seen a reason to assume the answer is no. I mean, again, you can always toss out the alien aspect. So, I mean, any of the rules that apply to us, like, well, you know, how fast is cell turnover? Maybe it's way slower. I don't see an intrinsic reason why that's impossible. So I'll take that as a yes.
What are the, I mean, there are some extremely old living beings on Earth, right? They're usually plant life, right? And fungus and stuff like that.
Yep.
I don't know what the oldest living biological, you know,
animal
is. I guess if you consider the symbiote an animal, I don't know.
Yeah, it certainly acts like an animal. I mean, you can think, I mean, there's turtles that can be like, you know, well over 100 years old, but I mean, 1,000, that's a long time.
Well, because we were kind of hoping that Dax was going to show up. So I'm still fingers crossed, season 4, season 5, we're going to see a Dax.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've kind of come up on it, and I just want to personally thank you guys for coming on the show and talking to us.
Thanks so much. It's fun.
Definitely.
Yeah, we've both been enjoying your web series, so we really appreciate you guys coming on. Oh, here.
Good. I'm glad.
Thank you. It was so much fun to record.
Yeah, it really was.
We'll have to have you guys back if you do another season.
Thank you.
Love to.
So that was our chat with Jane and Muhammad. I really enjoyed it. This is the first time we've had two guests on the show and kind of celebrity guests. And I think it went pretty well.
I think it went well, too. I was happy that they could both sort of chime in on both kinds of topics, whether we were talking about the story of Star Trek Discovery or the science aspect. They both had a lot to say.
So do you feel that you understand and appreciate the burn better now?
A little bit better. I feel something really clicked for you, I think.
I don't know. I get what they were trying to do. This gets to a lot of the things of the writers on the show, and it's a question of, you know what they're going for, but they don't always get there. And so they talk about it later and you're like, well, you say that, but I didn't get that, you know? And so I know what they were trying to do, and now I feel like I understand it better, and I have a little bit more hope that we're going to see more of Sukal in season 2, and that his mystical bio powers have some heft to them, and he will wield them in interesting ways in season 4.
Yeah, and I would say same for Book, which we were also talking about, might wield his mystical powers.
Yes, although I think Muhammad was using headcanon there. I don't think he was as involved in Book. I think Book is still an open book, and they could just, I think, I mean, my headcanon is Book is, because the way they describe it as an empath is, that sounds like he's biologically different than other human beings, either a subspecies or a different species.
Yeah, I didn't get that from, I got the feeling that it was everybody on his planet.
Yeah, well, but we'll see.
We'll see.
Okay, so before we go, every week we share a little bit of fun Star Trek thing that we learned this week or saw this week. I've got just a little thing, which is last weekend's episode of Celebrity Wheel of Fortune. There was a clue that spelled out resistance is futile. So a little bit of Star Trek on Celebrity Wheel of Fortune. And the person who got it right was Drew Carey. And what's interesting is he beat out Terry Hatcher, who actually was on Star Trek The Next Generation, but she didn't seem to have a clue about the clue. Pat Sajak did called Drew Carey a Trekker. We've got a video clip. If you go to our show notes or the episode on the website, you can watch the little moment.
And to be fair, there weren't any Borg in her episode.
Fair enough. So what do you got, Lori? What's your Trek bit of the week?
Mine is for, I know people are maybe sick of me talking about cool stuff I heard on the Delta Flyers podcast, but this one was really good, so I have to bring it up. I'm sorry. I'll try not to do it again. But Garrett Wang was telling this great story about, they were talking about Tim Russ and how committed he was to playing a Vulcan the same way that Leonard Nimoy did it. He was a big fan of the original series, and he really emulated Leonard Nimoy's performance. And so then Garrett said that he and Tim would hang out outside stages 8 and 9 when they were doing Voyager. And the two of them would act out word for word Spock's death scene from The Wrath of Khan. So Garrett was Kirk and Tim was Spock, and they had it completely memorized and would just play Star Trek and act out that scene over and over. And I just thought, for all of us who are like little kids playing Star Trek, to think that you could grow up, get paid to play Star Trek, and then still play other Star Trek on your break is kind of heartwarming.
He really is a genuine, I mean, there's a lot of people who are worked on the shows who are fans, but Tim really is. I mean, he's one of us.
Yeah. No, and I loved him as Tuvok, and I loved the way that he played a Vulcan. I thought was absolutely in keeping with that Spock tradition. So I loved that he and Garrett were just out there reenacting that scene. If that doesn't warm your heart, I don't know what will.
So thank you for joining us on another voyage of All Access Star Trek.
And that's it. We're going to go.
You know the drill. Come to the site, leave a comment, leave a comment on Apple, and we'll be back next Friday with a brand new episode.
All right. See you then.